This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, former Congresswoman and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney says we need a new breed of independent Black politicians. Author and scholar Dr. Gerald Horn has turned out yet another book, and a Black man from Africa has spent almost 30 years trying to get the U.S. government to stop calling him white. But first, a broad coalition of activist organizations is gearing up for 3 days of Rise Up October protests against police lawlessness in New York City this weekend. Organizers plan to bring in 100 family members of victims of police violence from around the country. Newark, New Jersey's People's Organization for Progress is part of the Rise Up October campaign. Chairman Larry Hamm says POP has been fighting police brutality in northern New Jersey for 35 years. POP sent several busloads to Washington, D.C. for the recent anniversary of the Million Man March.
The Million Man March anniversary, we took the relatives, a mother of one of the victims and relatives of three of the other victims on our buses with us. Sheila Reed, the mother of Jerome Reed, who was killed by police in Bridgeton, New Jersey. The dash cam video from the police vehicle went viral, showing him getting out of the car with his hands raised and empty, and him being shot at point blank range by Officer Brahim Days. And we also had friends and relatives of Abdul Kamal, who was killed in Irvington, shot at actually 15 times, hit 10 times. All he had in his hand was his cell phone. Kashad Ashford, who was shot 7 times, 4 times in the head. And Redaz Hearns, 14 years old, shot in the back 7 times, but he survived. And because he survived, they put all kind of charges. They're trying to charge him with possession of a weapon, which they say they found the next day, you know. And I couldn't make up some of these stories. So we're struggling to try to draw national attention to these cases and trying to mobilize the masses of people in the communities from which these young men came to fight for justice for them. So the theme in Washington was justice or else. And so we returned from there, essentially continuing the work that we were engaged in before we left. And that is to get justice for the victims of police brutality. I have to say, though, that it does appear that a national movement is coming into being. Certainly, I want to give credit to the young people in the Black Lives Matter movement. That term, it reminds me of the aftermath of the Occupy Wall Street. Everybody was occupying, you know, the occupying movement, and the word occupy became part, really, of the international lexicon. And in a similar way, it seems that the Black Lives Matter is finding its way not only into the national conversation, but certainly into the international conversation, to a point that Black Lives Matter was even mentioned during the Democratic Party presidential debate, was mentioned by candidate Bernie Sanders. So a movement is coming into being, and what we're trying to do at the People's Organization for Progress is really build our movement where we're at the local level, at the grassroots level. Now, one of the things that we have been demanding with regard to all four of the cases that I just mentioned to you, that of Abdul Kamal, Kashad Ashford, Jerome Reed, and Redaz Hearns, in the cases of Ashford, Abdul Kamal, Kashad Ashford, and Jerome Reed, grand juries in all three of those cases have already come back failing to indict the police officers that murdered those three men. The grand jury in the Redaz Hearns case is still out. So what we have been demanding in all four cases is that the U.S. attorney for New Jersey, Paul Fishman, meet with the family so that they could appeal to him to begin official civil rights investigations into the deaths of these young men. And if violations were found, to in fact prosecute the officers involved. This is what happened in the case of Earl Faison here in Orange, New Jersey. The state wouldn't even convene a grand jury, saying from the outset that the shooting was justified. But because of community pressure, the feds did come in, did do an investigation, said themselves that Faison died in a stairwell of torture. And after a year-long trial, convicted the officers. And then, even though they were convicted, it took two more years to actually get them into the jail after the appeals processes, because they appealed the guilty verdict. But they did go to jail. And so, learning from the Earl Faison situation, we're demanding federal investigations into these cases. And I have to report that the U.S. Attorney's Office has met, has had separate meetings, and I have been present at all those meetings, separate meetings with the families of Abdul Kamal, Kashad Ashford, and Jerome Reed. And the families made a direct appeal to U.S. Attorney Fishman and to that office to begin investigation. Now, one of the things I have to say is that as a result of our interaction with the U.S. Attorney's Office, it was clear to me that they have been monitoring closely these cases. In the discussions, it was clear that they had a lot of information, and we really couldn't tell them too much detail about the case, but they did want to hear what the families had to say, and they did want to know if there were any additional witnesses and so forth. They have begun a process to determine whether or not official investigations will be launched, and they will notify the families when they reach decisions in each case. I'm 61 years old, and I've been in the movement for 44 years. I started in the movement when I was 17. And this is the first time I can remember a U.S. attorney in New Jersey representing the Justice Department actually sitting down and meeting with the families in this manner. But I told the families, don't read more into it than is there. It was a meeting. Was it good that they met with us? Yes. But a meeting in and of itself is not an indictment and is not justice. So we have to keep the pressure on until we actually see the beginnings of the movement towards some type of judicial process that will put these officers on trial.
Now, as you said, you brought family members of victims to the Million Man March and the Rise Up October demonstrations that are coming off for this coming weekend in New York City will also be bringing family members of victims to the demonstrations.
Yes, and we're going to bring family members from New Jersey to stand with the family members, which they are assembling from across the country. And I want to urge people to participate in this demonstration. And I want to urge other organizations to participate in the demonstration. This is very important. October 22nd is considered within the movement a national day against police brutality. And so I would urge everybody, certainly within the Northeast region, to come and participate in the New York activities. It's going to be 3 days of activities. But if people are outside of the Northeast region or too far away, or for whatever reason cannot find their way to New York, they should have demonstrations at their local level. Because really, this is one of the challenges that faces us. We have to build strong movements at a local level so that we can not only have several thousand people assemble in New York City, but have several thousand people assemble in every city across America. Imagine that. If we were having large demonstrations in every major city in the United States simultaneously, what an impact that would have. It would be impossible for the major media to ignore.
And in fact, POP is already gearing up for Martin Luther King Week in January to put some protests into what often is just a day of remembrance.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the People's Organization for Progress is calling for January 15th. Now, January 15th is a Friday, is a work day. The holiday is the third Monday in January, and that would be, this year would be, I believe, January 18th. But we're calling for an international day of protest on Friday, January 15th, which is the actual birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. And in Newark, New Jersey, we are going to be meeting at 12 noon at the Lincoln Monument in Newark, New Jersey. And we are going to march, and we're going to march in such large numbers that we plan to shut down the downtown Central Business District in Newark on that day. Now, as I said, that's a Friday. That's a work day. That's not the day that we have off. But we're taking that day because we want to have an impact. We want a day of action and not just a day of commemoration. On the holiday, most people will be involved in some type of commemoration, either at their church or with their group or with their school or whatever. But we feel the best way to celebrate the life and the legacy of Martin Luther King and all of those who were involved in the civil rights movement is to be engaged in the fight, in the struggle for justice. It will have a greater impact if we actually march on his birthday, which is a business day. So we're urging everybody to take a vacation day, to take off work, take off school, and everybody, as we say, Martin Luther King, live like him, dare to struggle, dare to win. Everybody struggle on that day. So we're marching in Newark, but our position is, if for whatever reason you can't come to Newark, New Jersey, have a demonstration in your town, your city, where you live. And we think that would have a major impact if we had hundreds of cities across the United States and across the world, because we don't just want this to be a national day of protest. We want this to be an international day of protest with people all over the world protesting against racial injustice, economic inequality, and war. Those are the three things that Dr. King talked about. The struggle around those issues go on today. In fact, we're calling it the Martin Luther King March for Racial Equality, Economic Justice, and Peace.
This will certainly be a different character of event than the usual fare on Martin Luther King Week, which is often a celebration of how far we have come.
Well, brother, it's true that we have come a long way. And you know, I have to debate with a lot of people, but see, I'm old enough to remember, you know, how it used to be. And although we certainly have in no way gotten to the promised land, there was change. And that change was brought about through the sacrifice, through the lives that were given. Many people don't know how many people, scores of people, were killed during the civil rights movement. Their houses were bombed, people were shot, beaten to death, shot by the police, shot by the Klan, beaten to death. Many people who were activists lost their jobs. All kinds of sacrifices were made to bring about an end to the legal system of apartheid, the racial apartheid that existed in the United States, which was called Jim Crow, a term which obfuscated more than it revealed about, you know, an innocuous term. It was a evil system of racial control, oppression, and exploitation. And the centerpiece of that system, the legal apartheid, was brought to an end. But now we're still faced with the racial inequality that that system produced, the racial segregation that that system produced, the racial oppression that that system produced. We're still faced with that now. And fundamentally, the material condition of the mass of the people, relatively speaking, is in some regards even worse today than it was in 1968 when Dr. King was assassinated. So in one sense, we've come a long way, but in another sense, we have a long way to go. Look, in 1966, when Dr. King was still alive, there were approximately 100,000 black men in prisons across this country. Our percentage of the prison population was roughly equivalent to our percentage of the general population. We were roughly, according to the U.S. Census, 13% of the general population. We were 10% of the prison population. Since 1966, there has been a more than tenfold increase in the number of black people imprisoned across America. In fact, what has happened since the death of Martin Luther King has been the establishment of the mass incarceration state. We have gone from 10% of the federal prison population to over 50%, from 100,000 to now 1.2 million. Black and Latino people together make up more than 70% of state prison population. And when you take into account the number of people who are in federal prison, state prison, county jail, local jail, who are out on probation, who are under house arrest, who are in halfway houses, there are nearly 6 million black people under the authority of the criminal justice system in the United States of America. There are more people under the authority of the criminal justice system today than were officially enslaved in the United States in 1860. According to government figures, in 1860, there were 4 million enslaved persons in the United States. It was probably more than that, but that's the official figure. So what has arisen is a new form of slavery, the re-enslavement of black people through the mass incarceration state, through the prison industrial complex. And we're going to raise this issue certainly on January 15th, because Dr. King would have been raising this issue on January 15th. So the point I was trying to make is that, yes, we have removed legal live segregation in the United States of America, but in many ways, the actual material condition of black people has grown worse. Twice as many black people live in poverty today than in 1968, twice as many unemployed today, twice as many homeless. I mean, when you look at almost all indices of socioeconomic qualities of life, in many respects, we're doing worse now in 2015 than we were in 1968. So by this reality, we are compelled to fight. We have no other choice but to rise up. And January 15th should be a international day of uprising across this country and across the world. And once again, I urge people to participate in Rise Up October. I know my friend Cornel West, who marched with us when we had the Million People's March against police brutality, racial injustice, and economic inequality on July 25th. He will be marching in New York City with the Rise Up October activities. So we all should be there to support those direct action activities. And then when that's over, just like with the Million Man March, when these things are over, we have to return to our local communities and organize at the grassroots level and replicate those national demonstrations, replicate them at the local level. Make the year 2016 a year of struggle. And let's kick it off on the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King, January 15th, 2016.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. Cynthia McKinney, the former six-term congresswoman from Georgia and 2008 presidential candidate on the Green Party ticket, recently earned her Ph.D. in Leadership and Change from Antioch University. For her dissertation, McKinney explored the challenges faced by the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. She's now exploring ways to deploy more non-traditional black candidates for Congress, but that's easier said than done.
The electoral structure in the U.S. is very difficult because we don't have one national system. We have 50 separate systems governed by the rules of all of the different states. But where it is possible, the whole idea of a non-traditional candidate is not necessarily a non-democratic party candidate, because in some places it just doesn't make election sense because the election laws are so regressive. What I meant by that was Chokwe Lumumba type candidates, people who may previously have rejected being involved in the political process in electoral politics, but now who understand that the goal is a change of public policy. And the only way you're going to get the changed public policy is to have candidates who are committed to changing the current policies. And that's not going to come from people whose minds are closed or people who are wedded to the leadership that is responsible for the dire conditions that exist in our community now. And quite frankly, that's Democratic Party non-action.
So it sounds like you're talking about a resurgence of independent black politics. What is the state of independent black politics in the U.S. today?
It's been so set back. In 2005, 2006, 2005, of course, was the year of Hurricane Katrina. 2006, I believe that there actually was such a high disgust with the abject failure of the Democratic Party to do anything of substance with the masses of black votes that it accumulated. And with those black votes, empowered people to make public policy decisions on behalf of the black community. And then they failed. They totally failed. So 2006, I believe, was the time for something of substance to happen. If you remember what was going on at the time, there was the effort to impeach George W. Bush, and the Democrats had said, you put us in the majority in the Congress and we'll do impeachment and we'll roll back the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. And none of that was done. The people went to the polls and they dutifully voted Democratic. And then the war funding continued. The impeachment was put off the table. And, you know, Hurricane Katrina survivors are still trying to find their way back home. And so nothing was done. The Democratic Party's response to what I believe and perceive to be very real black anger, black voter anger, was the nomination of Barack Obama. And so people who should have known better, and I believe in many cases did know better, fell in line and said, oh, we can't press a demand because we've got to get this individual man elected to office. And so whatever public policy initiatives that could have been obtained or commitments that could have been obtained at the time, the Democratic Party got black vote for free. And we see what has happened to us because we gave our vote to the Democratic Party for free.
Well, of course, 2008 was a singular moment in history in that there was a black candidate for president of the United States. You, of course, have also been a black candidate for president of the United States, but one with the backing of one of the two big business parties. So would 2016 be an opening for that kind of independent black politics that you believe should have kicked into high gear after Katrina?
Well, it could, but unfortunately, the ingredients are there. In fact, it's almost like the cook in the kitchen, because the kitchen is fully stocked. It has everything that's needed in order to make a beautiful red velvet cake. It's got everything in the kitchen to make this beautiful cake. But first of all, you need a cook who knows the recipe, and you need a fully functioning oven, and you need some other things, you know? You need this kind of wisdom. And somehow, we've just regressed politically. Look at how far away we've come from Frederick Douglass, who said that power concedes nothing without a demand. There was a lot of emotionalism after Hurricane Katrina, and I tried to put forward some demands. Those demands were summarily rejected. I was laughed at. But demands like providing homes for homeless people, utilizing the Housing and Urban Development Department's housing stock. And now, look, we see the state of Utah doing that. We see the city of New Orleans doing just that. They're only focusing on the veterans, but the housing stock that exists inside the United States is enough to solve the homeless problem. We don't have to have homeless people. I also offered legislation after Hurricane Katrina to deny funding and federal equipment to any police department that was found to have violated the civil rights of the people that it's charged to serve. And of course, that was laughed at. And now look at what we're facing. So the answer to our problems, whether it's the economy, it's imprisonment, it's social justice of any sort, the answer is still a change in public policy. And that is only going to happen. I don't know how many times you got to get hit in the face before you understand that you're not going to get it from the current crop of players. The current crop of players are looking out for themselves, looking out for special interests, and the black community is not counted as a special interest the day after the election takes place.
From reading your letter, you seem to be saying that just as grassroots organizations should be putting forward a list of demands, so at the same time should people, as you describe them, inside the political process, that is, in the electoral political process, also be putting forward similar lists of demands. And that would scare the daylights out of the power structure, you say.
And actually, it's not even a similar list. It should be the same list, because inside or outside the system, the bottom line is that we're all outside. Whether you have the opportunity to cast a vote in the Congress or you don't, inside, you're still an outsider. But, you know, we have a mindset of individuals who believe that because they now get a chance to vote, that they're insiders. The one thing that my father always told me is that it doesn't matter if you get to vote or you don't get a vote, you're still an outsider. And our strength comes from the outside. The strength that we have on the inside only comes because of the strength of the outside. And if for any reason we fail to understand the connection between the inside and the outside, that means that those people on the inside are Rambos. They are just independent actors that have been completely divorced from the community. Now, they can come back to the community and they can talk a good game, But when they are there, they, as one member of Congress told me when I asked that all of the Congressional Black Caucus members to come to the Hurricane Katrina panel with me, just told me, well, Cynthia, you just got to understand that when the Democratic Party's leadership tells us not to do something, we're not going to do it. That is the mindset that has to be eliminated. Otherwise, the people who are charged with representing us don't represent us. They represent the leadership of the Democratic Party. And the leadership of the Democratic Party has fully well demonstrated that it doesn't care very much about public policy to address the concerns of the Black community, although they care very much about making sure that on Election Day, Black voters who unquestionably go to the polls and vote Democratic have the opportunity to do that, but don't ask for anything the day after or the day before the election.
Everybody listening to this interview is wondering whether you might be part of this coalition of independent Black congressional candidates or just act in an advisory kind of capacity.
Well, I took some time out and I worked on my PhD. I've completed that now. You can call me doctor. And it would be nice to have a doctor in the house who was not beholden to the Dr. Condoleezza Rice's and the Dr. Susan Rice's. But that's a question that I don't have an answer for yet. And the answer isn't really going to come from me. It's a question that all of us, I guess, have to pose to these voters. Is there a constituency for Cynthia McKinney in the political process in the United States? That's a question that needs to be asked and answered by the people who do the voting and the supporting.
Former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, speaking from Atlanta, Georgia. Mustafa Hefni was born in Egypt and immigrated to the United States more than 3 decades ago. The U.S. government granted him citizenship, but it refuses to acknowledge that he's a Black man. Mr. Hefni is a Nubian, an ancient, unmistakably Black people who were part of the Egyptian Empire and sometimes ruled as pharaohs. Nubians have always lived in what is now southern Egypt and northern Sudan. But the United States classifies Nubian immigrants from southern Egypt as white and Nubians from northern Sudan as Black under Directive 15 of the U.S. Office of Management and Budget. So, for almost 30 years, Mustafa Hefni has been demanding that the United States recognize him as a Black man.
In 1987, the Director of Human Resources sent all employees a form called Race Ethnic Identification Card. We were requested to indicate our race on this card. I indicated that I am Black. A few days later, the Director of Human Resources sent me a letter threatening me that my education career would be ruined if I did not change my racial classification on this form from Black to white. And a few days later, one of the top administrators at Wayne County Regional Education Service Agency where I worked, he called me to his office and said, if you ever say you're Black again, no one will hire you. And if hired, you'll be running from one job to the other for the rest of your life. I kept saying that I am Black and that I'm proud of being Black. And they did not fire me right away. They denied me promotions twice. They harassed me. They ridiculed me. They called me nigger. And they persecuted me to the point that I left the school district on social security psychiatric disability, which lasted 10 years. After I recovered, I went back into the workforce. I was fired 5 times because Wayne County Regional Education Service Agency and NHLS followed up on their threat. I was fired 5 times.
The United States government, through its Office of Management and Budget, has a directive which says that people who come from Egypt, even if they are of Nubian ancestry, and you are unmistakably Black, as are the Nubian people, that these Egyptian Nubians must be classified as white, while right across the border in southern Nubia, which is northern Sudan, those people are classified by the United States government under Directive 15 as being black.
Even though that they are one group of black people, they used to be one nation, okay? One group of black people, half of it is classified as blacks and the other half is classified as whites. Doesn't make any sense, does it?
No, it doesn't. And you pursued this. You wrote letters to the EEOC, you have filed suit, and you even approached your congressman, Detroit's black congressman, John Conyers, asking him to help change that Office of Management and Budget directive.
Correct. I wrote to him 5 times, asking him to introduce a bill in Congress to include the Egyptian Nubians in the definition of black person found in Directive number 15 of the Office of Management and Budget. He did not respond. I called his office 5 times to follow up on my 5 letters. They told me that he was busy. And then I wrote a letter to President Obama regarding my ordeal and the ordeal of other Egyptian Nubians. And the letter was sent by certified mail. It was received in the White House on July 12, 2012. He did not respond to my letter. I wrote to his wife, Mrs. Michelle Obama, a letter, and I sent her a copy of my letter to the president, asking her to forward it to him. She did not respond. The letter was received in the White House on September 27, 2012. Did not respond. And then I had 100 African-American pastors write to Congressman John Conyers, asking him to hand deliver my letter to the president. He refused to do so. And then I had, in 2013 and 2014, I had 6 African-American civil rights leaders and pastors write to Congressman Conyers, asking him to introduce a bill in Congress to include the Egyptian Nubians in the definition of black person found in Directive number 15 of the Office of Management and Budget. He refused to do so.
Yes, now you have suffered financially from numerous firings and such, and you've been bankrupted, but you have offered to drop any monetary claims in return for just a change in classification.
Correct. This is a matter of principle to me. I've been fighting this for 28 years, okay? Because it's a matter of principle to me. I am willing to lay down my life for the cause of black racial pride and the cause of restoring the Nubian civilization to the black race. So this is why I'm not asking for any money, because it's a matter of principle to me.
Yes, you've sued the federal government or attempted to sue the federal government, charging that your constitutional rights have been violated by their arbitrary designation of you as a white man.
Correct. The case is still open, by the way.
And how does the United States violate your constitutional rights when they decide that you are not black?
It takes away my pride. It takes away my identity. It violates me completely. I feel violated and I feel insulted.
Now, you've been in the United States a long time. You are probably aware that Puerto Ricans and other people of Hispanic descent were, for a very long time, classified as white as long as they had a Spanish surname, no matter what they appeared to be racially.
Correct. See, white people in power are afraid that they will become a minority one day. So they want to inflate their numbers by any means, by classifying other people as whites.
Yes, but you also had problems when you applied for a job in the Detroit school system, and that's a black system.
Correct. See, Wayne County, Teresa, is over 36 school districts in Wayne County. It's the link between the state level and the local level. The superintendents of 36 school districts attend a meeting with the superintendent of Wayne County, Teresa, once a month. Okay, to discuss policy and what's happening at the state level and what the state wants the local districts to do and stuff like that. Okay, so they have a lot of connections. And this is how I was blocked. I applied, I passed a test, English test and language and professional test, and I passed and everything, and I received 2 letters that I am qualified for the position of elementary teacher and bilingual teacher, 2 positions. And then nothing happened. I've called so many times to follow up. I went to the office to follow up. They do not want to hire me.
What do other Nubians from Egypt and from Sudan, whom you know here in the United States, say about your predicament and your complaint?
All of them are proud of being black. All of them want to be classified as blacks, not white. As a matter of fact, I am organizing hundreds of them. I'm organizing hundreds of Egyptian Nubians right now so that they would file a class action lawsuit against the government to have the racial classification changed from white to black.
Yes, I see you have a letter from the Nubia Project representing other Nubians
Correct.
In the United States who support your demand.
Correct. I have their support.
You've also gone to the United Nations. One would think that the international body would have a different perspective than the narrow United States historical view of race.
I'm glad that you brought this up because there has been a change in the plan now. We're going to come up with a new petition and we're going to send it to the UN Commissioner on Human Rights, accusing the government of genocide and destruction of my culture. The activists that I'm working with right now are very, very politically astute, and they are going to go this way. We're going to file and we're going to come up with a new petition, and this will move the cause a great deal further.
Destruction of your culture by the federal government, essentially
Correct.
Saying that black people do not exist in southern Egypt.
Correct. Correct.
And therefore,
Correct.
Blacks from southern Egypt who come to the United States are no longer black or not black here.
Exactly. They robbed us from our identity, our racial identity.
There was one authority you did not mention appealing to, and that is the government of Egypt.
Correct.
Why is that?
I don't know what they can do for me. I don't know. See, there are no racial categories in Egypt. The racial categories are informal. If you're Nubian, everybody knows that you're black because you're Nubian, and you know that you're black because you're Nubian. And if you are tan, you are tan because of your physical appearance. If you are dark, you're dark because of your physical appearance. But we don't have any official racial classification system in Egypt. So what can he do for me, the president of Egypt? I don't know.
That was Mustafa Hefni. Dr. Gerald Horn, the professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, has written yet another book. Horn is one of the most prolific and influential black political thinkers of our time. His most recent work is titled Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. His new book on the Haitian Revolution should be out this week. And after that, Dr. Horn plans on turning out books on Paul Robeson and on black majority rule in South Africa. He was recently interviewed on WFHB Community Radio in Bloomington, Indiana.
The book Counter-Revolution of 1776 seeks to revise the heroic creation myth of the origins of the United States of America, a creation myth that I'm afraid to say too many of our friends on the left have bought into. What I fundamentally suggest is that when the rebels in North America rebelled against London, in many ways, they were emulating the rebels in what was then southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, who rebelled against London in November 1965. The latter rebels were rebelling against the idea that London was moving towards African majority rule that would effectively circumscribe white supremacy. The former, meaning those who founded the United States, were rebelling because, from their point of view, London was moving all too speedily, step by step, towards abolition of slavery, which would, of course, dispossess the fortunes of many of the founding fathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, even John Hancock. And rather than await for that fate to arrive, they preemptively rebelled and threw London out of the country. Now, this story, in order to get a fuller understanding, has to go beyond, for example, the Somerset case in June 1772, where the court in London ruled that slavery could not obtain in England, a ruling that was quickly followed by a companion ruling that said that slavery could not obtain in Scotland. You really have to go back to the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, which, amongst other things, involved the monarch, the king, taking a step back, and as the rising merchant class began to take steps forward. This led to an effective deregulation of the African slave trade, which theretofore had been under the thumb of the monarch, trade in Africans. That is to say, rather than one company, or the Royal African Company, under the thumb of the monarch controlling the trade, it was opened up, it was deregulated, and a number of merchants were able to enter this lucrative trade, which at times brought profits of over 1,700%, and therefore they descended upon Africa with the maniacal energy of crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean, which up until the mid-18th century, circa 1750, was thought to be more valuable than the North American mainland. The problem is that the Africans began to rebel because oftentimes they outnumber the Europeans, sometimes at a rate of 10 to 1 or 20 to 1. This causes what I refer to as the Great Strike, and parentheses, scholars and students of South African history should recognize that term, Great Trek. The Great Trek of the planters from the islands to the mainland, but there too they encountered rebellious Africans, not least in 1739 in Stono's Revolt, perhaps the bloodiest revolt in colonial British history, that is to say slave revolt, where the Africans rose up and began to massacre the Europeans and then began to try to Spanish Florida. Because, of course, Spain, which controlled Florida at that particular time, was trying to cut deals with the Africans under the Union Jack, under the British flag, in South Carolina, and that was a rather effective strategy. The settlers in the Carolinas and in Virginia in particular were beginning to think that London was becoming wobbly on the bedrock issue of enslavement of Africans, because London was increasingly having to enlist Africans in their armed forces in order to confront the Spanish, for example, in Cartagena and what is now Colombia in circa 1740, in terms of hemispheric jousting over control of the Americas. And the settlers thought that Africans should not be placed in red coats and have rifles or muskets thrust into their hands. They should be marched into tobacco fields at gunpoint in order to create lucrative profits for the settlers themselves. So this was creating a rift between the settlers and London, a rift that was exacerbated by the fact that the African slave trade and slavery was creating enormous wealth, creating allied industries in North America of shipping, of insurance to insure against slave revolts, for example, of banking in order to finance these lucrative slave voyages. And as the productive forces in North America began to increase in burgeon, the North American colonies were increasingly becoming a competitor of London as opposed to a colony, and all that set the stage for the revolt against British rule in 1776, leading to the creation of the United States of America. Now, of course, the settlers had a problem because so many of the Africans were fleeing to British lines because they saw freedom and liberty as coming from aligning with London. And so this provided an incentive for the settlers to create enticements, emoluments, and inducements to attract more Europeans across the Atlantic, where they enter into the hallowed halls of whiteness with militarized identity politics, which still is bedeviling this country to this very day. And I will say this, that the revolt against British rule to create the United States was a step forward in terms of trying to leap out of the quagmire of religious identity politics. That is to say, Europe wracked by Christian versus Jewish or Catholic versus Protestant, for example, Spanish Catholics versus British Protestants. The United States did an end run around that quagmire, because when arriving on these shores, the European religionists, be they Christian or be they Catholic or Protestant, were redesignated as, quote, white, unquote. And this, of course, was quite helpful in terms of subduing a continent, because, as my story tells the tale, there was also incredible resistance and militancy by the Native American groupings in North America, who oftentimes, of course, were allied with the Africans. And so, in some ways, what I'm trying to suggest is that one cannot begin to understand the United States today with the sickening litany of police killings of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Freddie Gray in Baltimore and Sandra Bland in Texas and Eric Garner in Staten Island and Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, for the overrepresentation on death row or overrepresentation in prison, the disparity in terms of life expectancy, the fact that black youth are more likely to be suspended from school than other groups. You can't begin to understand that without understanding this story of 1776, because when you fight a war like the Africans did in league with the British, and then you lose the war, you can expect to be punished and tormented for all time, including your descendants, until you can turn the table by lengthening the battlefield and gathering and garnering global allies who then you can pressure the U.S. ruling elite to change the status quo, which is precisely what happened during the 20th century when Washington found it difficult to point the finger of accusation at the socialist camp in terms of human rights violations as long as Jim Crow obtained in the United States of America. As many historians, including myself, have pointed out, this created a dynamic that led to the retreat of Jim Crow. But the problem today in 2015 is, of course, that as a result of that bargain, many of our black organizations broke their ties with international and global forces. This came to me, quite frankly, a few weeks ago when leaders of the world, Vladimir Putin, Barack Obama, Xi Jinping of China, Raul Castro of Cuba, are all descending on New York. And I expected, given Black Lives Matter, given the often inflamed rhetoric about a state of emergency in black America, that there would be mass protests in the United Nations, because that's what would have happened in 1951 when Paul Robeson was doing that sort of thing. But I did not notice that. And what that tells us, of course, is that adopting the most efficacious political tactics and strategy is not just a matter of a simple-minded analysis. It's really a matter of ideology, and that's where we're lacking today as we speak.
Dr. Gerald Horn was interviewed by WFHB's Doug Storm. Horn spoke of the need for a more coherent ideological struggle in black America and the importance of forging international alliances.
One of the points that I'm trying to convey is, once again, to reiterate, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, that to the extent that we've made progress with regard to black equality, black freedom, that it's oftentimes been dependent upon an international correlation of forces or actual international allies. My book on the Haitian Revolution, which you kindly mentioned will be out in 9 days, really makes the argument that you can't begin to understand the abolition of slavery in the United States of America without understanding the Haitian Revolution. That is to say that in this historical revolutionary process on the island of Hispaniola, when tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of formerly enslaved Africans arose as one between 1791 and 1804, the first successful slave revolt in the hemisphere, if anywhere else for that matter, that helped to create a general crisis for the slave system that could only be resolved with the collapse of that system throughout the hemisphere. That is to say that the leading slave power, Britain, flipped after the Haitian Revolution. First, they tried to squash the Haitian Revolution in the 1790s and suffered one of the most ignominious defeats in British imperial history. And then, rather chastened, they sought to ally with the Haitian revolutionaries against their antagonists across the channel, that is to say France. France had been the colonizing power in Haiti, and also against their rising antagonists, that is to say the United States of America. The British were quite concerned that, like revolutionaries anywhere, that the Haitian revolutionaries would begin to try to spread their gospel in Jamaica, a former British colony, and Barbados, a former British colony, and in other British colonies, such as St. Kitts and Nevis, the home, the place where Alexander Hamilton was born. And they felt that the better part of wisdom dictated that they work out an entente with Haiti. And once that entente was worked out, that helped to create enormous pressure on the United States of America, which then helped to precipitate a U.S. Civil War that led to the abolition of slavery. And so that's why I'm seeking to tell the story time and time again. That is to say, we need to overthrow and vitiate this rather pernicious idea of so-called American exceptionalism. That is to say, the United States stands outside of global trends and global currents. It's a thing in and of itself. Its history is only dictated by internal machinations. And instead, the United States, as we would see any other country. For example, I'm working on a book now on the anti-apartheid struggle. And there's no doubt in my mind that when Nelson Mandela took the oath of office in the spring of 1994, that his victory is not only a victory of the people of South Africa, it was a victory of the people of the frontline states, that is to say Angola and Zambia and Tanzania, that had suffered in order to free South Africa. It was a victory for the Scandinavian countries, which had given so much aid to the African National Congress of Nelson Mandela. It was a victory for the anti-apartheid movement in the United States, the movement that tried to force campuses like Indiana University to divest from corporations that had holdings in apartheid South Africa. It was a victory for the socialist camp, particularly Cuba, because its defeat of the apartheid army on the battlefields of Angola in 1988 was really the key factor in causing the apartheid rulers to negotiate more seriously, because there was a fear that the Cuban troops, having bested them in southern Angola, would march onward to Pretoria and oust them forcibly from office. And rather than suffer that indignity, they decided to negotiate seriously. So I guess what I'm saying is that in terms of understanding progressive development, not just the liberation of South Africa or the emancipation of enslaved Africans in the United States, you really need a global analysis if you're going to get the full flavor and the full story.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.